This is Regenerative Skills, the podcast helping you to learn the skills and solutions to create an abundant and connected future. I'm your host, Oliver Gaucher. Are you left wanting more at the end of each episode of this show? Are these short sessions getting you fired up to try new skills for yourself and share the journey with others who are working through the same challenges? Well, the good news is that this podcast is only the beginning. The real action and learning is happening on the Regenerative Skills Discord channel, where you can connect with the whole community to dive deeper into the topics on the show, explore solutions, and share your journey and blooper reel with an active group that can't wait to hear from you. You can get your questions answered and share knowledge and wisdom of your own on a safe platform that, unlike the social media giants, won't steal your personal data to advertise to you in creepy ways. Ditch Facebook and join us where the real skill builders are. Just find the link to the Discord chat on the homepage at regenerativeskills.com. Hey there, everybody, and welcome back. So after last week's episode on beekeeping, I wanted to go deeper into the all too often overlooked world of insects. Now, though there are only a handful of bugs and invertebrates that humans consider edible, productive, or beautiful, they are all essential elements in any healthy ecosystem. Now, all too often, the ones that we don't find beautiful or derive uses from are considered an annoyance at best, or actively destroyed and eradicated in all too many cases. And it's long overdue that I highlight just how valuable insects are to our world and our own well-being on this show. And to help me to do that in this episode is Vicky Hurd. Now, Vicky is the strategic lead on agriculture for the Wildlife Trust UK, and was until recently head of the Sustainable Farming Campaign for Sustain, the Alliance for Better Food and Farming. She's also a published author and runs an independent consultancy. As an experienced and award-winning environmental campaigner, researcher, writer, and strategist, working for the past 30 years mainly on food, farming, and environmental issues and solutions, Vicky has worked on government policy for many years, authoring Perfectly Safe to Eat, The Facts on Food in 2000, and has led teams at FOE, War on Want, WSPA, and Safe Alliance. She has co-founded many organizations, including Sustain, Hackney Food Partnership, and the Eating Better Alliance, and has written and campaigned extensively at a global, EU, and national level. Vicky's other passion is insects and other invertebrates, and is a fellow at the Royal Entomological Society as well. Her new book, Rebugging the Planet, The Remarkable Things That Insects and Other Invertebrates Do, and Why We Need to Love Them More, will be our focus of today's conversation. Vicky helps me to understand the significance of invertebrates in ecosystems, exploring their role, their challenges, and their conservation efforts. Together, we go over how promoting biodiversity, sustainable practices, and community engagement is crucial to protect these essential species and support whole ecosystem health. We also cover practical actions that anyone can take to support insect habitats in their area, such as adopting habitat-friendly gardening practices, advocating for conservation policies, and understanding the impact of individual actions on invertebrates to maintain the delicate balance of nature. So from here, I'll hand things over now to Vicky Hurd. Well, welcome, Vicky. It's a pleasure to catch up with you. Thank you so much for making time to be on the show today.
Oh, you're welcome. Very happy to chat. About my book, Rebugging the Planet.
I've got a copy here as well, but it's a digital one, so I can't hold it up. I am really excited to explore this topic with you, first of all, because it is something that is so overlooked in the conversation, even around regeneration in general and trying to revive soils and grow all types of plants and food. Mm-hmm. Many people don't recognize the importance of insects and invertebrates. Now, before we go deeper into this, can you help us to understand what we mean by bugs? Because it's quite a range.
Yes, it is. And for some people, it can mean a tummy bug, things like that. But I use that phrase because it was quite, a lot of people talk about rewilding, and they were even talking about rebirding as critical for our planet. And I thought, well, if they're using that, why not rebugging? And I just started thinking of that as a tool, but it's not perfect. If you're an entomologist, it's wrong, because there's such a thing as true bugs, which are the sap-sucking invertebrates. But I really use the term to talk about all the invertebrates that are really important for us, for our food system, for our water, for our nature. You know, we can talk about that, but it's all the spineless ones, the critical spineless things out there. And so, you know, I use it in a very loose term.
Well, this also spans quite a range of sizes as well. We think of bugs as generally being pretty small, but there are fairly large ones. There are bugs in the air, they're on the ground, in the plants, in our soil. How broadly are we looking at this here?
Well, I was thinking about it in terms of creatures that are actually sort of critical to us. And that does mean all of them. You know, octopus could be, you know, under my definition of without a spine, you know, octopuses and squids in the marine environment. But I do tend to talk more about the terrestrial invertebrates in this. But I do touch on the marine ones as well, because they are absolutely critical, not least in terms of regulating sea temperatures and the ability of those environments to regulate themselves. And those small zooplankton in the marine environment are absolutely critical part of the food system as well. And they eat a lot of the phytoplankton, which absorb a lot of the greenhouse gases. And on it goes. It's such a complex web. But as you say, a lot of people don't see what part of the web the invertebrates organize. And actually, a lot of the time, it's a lot of it. They're a critical part of, for instance, transporting microbes and fungal spores through a soil system. And people just think, you know, we know more now about the impact of fungi and how important they are, but you don't think how those spores get transported. And a lot of them are transported on the skin of the earthworm, things like that. And then above ground, pollination services and, you know, all the soil services. And also what they do in terms of keeping our nutrients cycled, which absolutely essential. And that's all the way from your slugs and your snails to your centipedes. You know, loads of the invertebrates are doing that waste disposal process that we don't do. And we would be knee deep, far more than knee deep in muck and plant matter and worse, dead bodies, if we didn't have the invertebrates.
A good point. And it seems like a lot of importance has been given into the microbiome, the role of bacteria and microbes, as well as fungi, like you mentioned earlier.
Yeah.
Somehow we went from the tiniest members of life and then up until, you know, birds and mammals. And we seem to have skipped this spot of insects and invertebrates in between. Now, you already talked about some of the reasons why they're so important in this very complex, interconnected web of life that they represent. What would you say to somebody who has a terrible connotation with bugs and just doesn't like them, thinks they're gross, finds them annoying? Why should they care? Why are they valuable to their life?
I completely understand that. And a lot of people are. And a lot of that, most of that, in fact, when I actually looked into it, is to do with how they were brought up. You know, their carers or their parents or somebody had just put the fear or put the disgust into them. And that often lasts a long time, unless you start to examine your attitude. And I've got a chapter quite early on in the book called Rebugging Your Attitude. And I've got it quite early on because I think what you're talking about is really critical to get people to understand this and therefore take the measures, either as individuals, as voters, or as anybody with the power to change what we're doing. You've got to change attitudes. And I think one of the great ways of doing that is actually to get rebugging your garden or your home. And then you can start to share what you're doing. And our smartphones these days, you know, bad as they are in some ways, they're brilliant for sharing, as we know. And you can zoom in. So you've got tiny creatures. Once you zoom in, you can see how beautiful they are. And if you learn a bit about them, you can share their beauty and their incredible importance. Like the hoverfly, you know, hoverflies are extraordinary to look at when you look up close, and they're incredible waste disposal. They're incredible pollinators, you know. And so once people start to understand that, and particularly when they talk to children they care about, because children are generally born with a complete fascination with these creatures that look totally unlike us, not furry mostly, although some of the moths are beautifully furry. But children have that fascination, and it can be completely destroyed by a unfortunate word, you know, that's going to sting you. So if you're a carer, you could really do a lot by rebugging your attitude and how you talk to those in your care about these bugs, and do some bug hunts. I've got lots of ideas in the book and on my website about things you can do with children to get them to not get the fear. And you'll start to learn and have a great time too. I mean, some of the best times I've ever had have been on bug hunts with children. It's just such fun. And you don't have to touch the invertebrates at all. You just look at them and take photographs and watch. And sometimes I think, you know, just watching small little things can be good for your mental health. You know, there's a lot in mindfulness about sort of taking time, processing and watching. And actually one of the difficult things with children is to actually get them to stay still and quiet. So it's a good process.
Yeah, I've seen that full spectrum as well from kids who were given space and encouragement to play around and become familiar with all the creepy crawly critters around in their environment, and others who, you know, their parents or whoever helped to raise them had these negative connotations, and that really formed the way that they did or did not interact with the creepy crawlies around them. And so, I mean, it really does. It comes with us later into life, and it takes a real effort at a certain point to reverse that or to get over some of those connotations, but it is so important. And so between the value that you talk about that they give in so many different sectors of our direct lives, to say nothing about aspects of the ecology that we're not nearly as aware of, what are some of the direct connections beyond pollination or waste disposal that you have found that people connect with and can help to open the door for repairing or rebugging your attitude, like you said?
Yeah. One of the best things I ever shared on Twitter or X was a graphic that I got from Chris Packham, who's a sort of prominent environmentalist here, his website or something. And it was a picture of a spider, and your common house spider. And it had all around it all the things that the spider eats in your garden, in your house. And it got shared so much because people were saying, I had no idea. You know, I don't like these other things. So I can have, if I look after that spider in my house, I can get rid of them. That's slightly negative. But on the other hand, that's life. That's, you know, we all have an impact on the environment just by having a house, just by eating, by clothing ourselves. So if you can think about creating an ecosystem where you live, in your house or in your garden, then you can actually get some services back, which is great. Other things, I think there's a certain thing I talk about in the book about beauty, and, you know, I was touching on mindfulness, but the beauty around us wouldn't be here if we didn't have the invertebrates doing the soil processes, for instance, the earthworms creating the air spaces and water spaces in the soil system. You wouldn't have the flowers. And if you didn't have the flowers, you wouldn't have the birds and bees and the, you know, so on and so forth. So those, all those processes are critical. And in your water, people don't often realize how much filtering the invertebrates in a water system do. I talk about a little one called a rotifer, which is very present in our water systems, and nematodes as well, which are tiny worms. Loads of different invertebrates in water systems cleaning it for us, taking the debris out and doing a job that we don't pay them for. And we're often pouring in loads of chemicals into those water systems without thinking. So if, you know, if you can avoid doing that, that's brilliant, not doing it using sort of harsh chemicals and pesticides. And I was speaking earlier about the fact that they can act as transporters within a system. I think there's an awful lot we don't know as well. When I was reading about the earthworms transporting the spores, you start to think about, well, the microbes within those invertebrates, you know, in their stomachs, an incredibly important way of inoculating a new area. And that must be true not just of earthworms, but the flies, the, you know, all the beetles that are traveling through a system, the invertebrates that are flying, which obviously allows them to go much further. Some of them can travel thousands of miles, as we know with the monarch butterfly, which is an incredible migrant across America. And here, again, hoverflies thousands of miles, and they're transporting all the spores, the microbes in their stomach to a new environment. Do we really know what's happening there? And that, particularly when it comes to fungi and fungal spores, but also other microbes, you know, taking that away, what are we doing? You know, is, you know, we might be making a massive difference by removing a particular flying insect from the system. And as we know, one of the reasons I wrote the book was because we know now that we're losing a lot, particularly of those flying invertebrates, insects, because of long-term studies, which is what prompted me to write the book in the first place, actually, the terrifying data showing that we've lost a dramatic amount of our invertebrates. And that was, Germany has done a lot of good long-term studies. But all over the world, we're seeing that decline. And it's not surprising. There's all sorts of ways we're harming them. But what are the impact? What's the impacts? You know, there's a lot to look at. And the interactions between them. I've got to, I won't tell it, but the story in my book about wolf spiders and their eating, mine's gone blank. The wolf spiders eat a lot of invertebrates and they do an important role in that. But they eat springtails in Arctic regions. And I won't go any further with it, but you can look at that case study, which is quite extraordinary and unexpected implications if you remove the wolf spider.
Mm. Yeah, well, let's dig deeper into that now and look at the threats and the statistics of what is happening to our bug biome around the world.
It's really worrying. I mean, as I said, that was one of the reasons I actually started on a train. I was just reading some really frightening statistics about sort of 50% drops in flying insects in some long-term studies in Germany, I think, and other studies about pollinators, you know, the bee declines and the impacts of climate change, which can affect these animals are mostly very large surface area to volume ratio. So they lose water and they lose heat, or they gain heat and drown, but they're really small. So it's very hard for them to regulate. So they're very affected by immediate climate change. That said, they're very adaptable. They can move, they can produce vast amounts of offspring. So they have all those advantages, but they're really being affected. I think New Scientist did a big piece on earthworm impacts of climate change, and it was really dramatic. And I was learning about that, and I wrote 50 ways to help the bugs. And then that ended up, by pure chance, turning it into a book. But it's things like climate change. It's loss of habitat. And as important, you know, because habitat loss comes as a result of clearance for housing, critically from farming. Our farming has got so uniform, such large fields. You're losing the hedgerows, you're losing the small woodlands and trees, little scrubby bits that all get taken up for producing food. And that also fragments areas. So you've got small islands of great, you know, biodiversity and great wildlife. But if it's like miles away from anywhere with no corridor in between, like a hedgerow or verges or trees to travel through safely, it'll stay in that fragmented bit. And we start to see even more decline because they can't stay in one area and thrive. They have to be able to move through the system. So that fragmentation is really important. There's also pollution, massive pollution problem as a result of pesticides used in garden environments and in the farmed environment, and other chemicals, fertilizers, and, you know, bleaches and things we pull down our sinks. So all those things. And there are new things people are starting to realize are really important, such as light pollution. The impact of light pollution on moths is potentially causing massive declines, up to 50% loss in some studies. And those moths, we now know, also are very critical pollinators. They're nighttime pollinators, a lot of them. So again, what are we doing? You know, often people think of pollinators being the bees and the wasps, but moths are just as important. So we've got light pollution that stops them being able to navigate and find where they need to go safely at nighttime. And it stops mating and other processes which are essential. So noise pollution, even radiation. You know, the 5G and above radiation in our phones have been known to cause such high levels of energy within a system. It can potentially cook the bees. Again, rather alarming. So there's lots of ways that we are harming them, but it also means lots of ways we can stop doing that. And that's what I wanted the book to be about. So there's all the way through, there's tips, things on all those things that you can play your part as an individual, as part of society, as a parent or a carer, as a consumer. So many ways you can do something to help them.
Well, look, we did breeze over a lot of these big causes of the die-off of insects in so many different categories. You mentioned how, agriculture plays such a big role in this, of course, because it is the largest land use industry across the entire world. And seeing as you also work in as an advocate for regenerative agriculture, let's start with farming first and talk about how we can invite insects back onto our place and how that isn't necessarily a bad thing for people who are trying to control them for needs of the enterprises of the farm.
Yeah. Well, there's lots of things to say about that. And I think one of the issues that people often don't realize is that a lot of what farmers are producing, they're producing because the food industry is driving them to produce that. It's not necessarily, this sounds a bit odd, what consumers want or need, rather, because a lot of what we tend to want is driven by marketing and advertising. And I won't say too much about that, but it actually has such a big impact on what farmers are doing that it's too easy to say, oh, farmers have got to do something differently, or we've got to pay farmers subsidies to do things differently. Actually, the whole system has to change. And we waste a third to 40% of the food produced in the cropping areas and livestock. We waste that in along the chain. A lot of it's wasted in the home. But it's also wasted because supermarket specifications of colour or, you know, size or perfection produce and all those things mean food waste. They also mean that farmers are having to use chemicals to curb the natural processes that happen within a soil system or even in a tree, you know, apple tree. Some of the most sprayed with pesticide fruits are apples because the industry have told us that they all need to be a perfect size and a perfect appearance, perfect shape with no blemishes. And in fact, I say in my book, you know, if you bite into an apple and it's got a worm of some sort or, a moth larvae, you should be pleased because that means it's not been dosed with chemicals. So
that's actually farmers, healthier for you than the perfect looking one.
Yes. Yeah. And that's just a good source of protein, but most people don't want to eat bugs. But it's flippant, but it is true. So you can make a difference. But farmers have been pushed over decades, you know, all last century, to produce more for less money, more perfect at a certain time. And it's more commoditized as well, which means it's uniform produce that can be sold anywhere in the world. And that means it's going to be the cheapest because the buyers, the manufacturers or the supermarkets will go to where it's cheapest. And that means farmers all around the world are competing with each other to produce the grains, the oil seeds, the fats, the livestock meat at the cheapest possible point. And that's causing huge problems to the etiquettes. In livestock systems, it means huge amount of feeds going into the system because you're feeding the animals rather than letting them feed on the grass, which, you know, ruminants, for instance, the cows and the sheep and the goats are used to. They're being fed crops, and those crops are fed pesticides, they're fed fertilizers, and in very large fields. So you're losing all those edge of field habitats, which are critical for the invertebrates. And then with the cropping systems, like I was talking about apples, but also in, you know, cereals, it means a, you know, huge amount of uniform cereals in large areas, in huge prairies across the US. All that is extremely harmful. So we need to be revisiting that. Every farmer needs to be able to make the decisions to have more rotations. More rotations means more crops every year. Instead of having just an oil seed, an oil crop, a grain, and then another grain, they could do a grain a year when it's just got cover crops. Cover crops are where you've got the soil being protected by a crop, which you could then plow into the soil to give it nutrients. And those cover crops are now known in regenerative systems to be absolutely essential because also it means the soil is covered when you've got bad weather and that, so the soil isn't running off. So, you know, and then doing a protein crop like a legume, which is peas or beans. And those crops are actually brilliant because they have nodules in their soil, in their roots, which allow nitrogen fixing bacteria to take nitrogen from the atmosphere and turn it into useful nitrogen products, which the plant and the fungi and the invertebrates in the soil all use. You know, it's an incredibly complex and brilliant system. But if you can have rotations that involve lots of different crops over a longer period, that's far better for the invertebrates. But you need to have a outlet for those products, you know, as opposed to what you had before, which was cheap grain over, you know, over a period. So those kind of decision-making processes that farmers can make are only enabled for them if the market, the buyer, is saying, I'll take a different thing from you. I'll take it looking not so perfect. Those carrots don't have to look so perfect. Or the government is actually supporting them in doing those different processes. Another thing is integrated pest management, which is using different tools to control pests and weeds in your crop. This is a brilliant area, which is a massive growth across the globe. I'd love all farmers to go organic, but they just can't. Organic, you know, is a great tool and it's taught a lot of farmers a lot and it's a brilliant goal to aim for. But it's difficult for many farmers to do that. So starting through integrated crop management, integrated pest management, using different crops that are resistant to pests and disease and weeds, using intercropping where you're using crops in between each other. So not just one crop. And that confuses the bugs and processes like that, but also really inviting the helpful invertebrates in by having hedgerows, having beetle banks within or flower banks within the field. These are all systems that farmers have been using for a while now in regenerative systems. And those hedgerows and flower strips can host beetles and other invertebrates, which are then eating the slugs and the aphids and the other unwanted pests that you don't want, or they're eating the weeds. And so you're using nature to replace your pesticides, and you use pesticides as a very last resort. It's right down the bottom of this. So that's a brilliant way of reintroducing nature into your farm system whilst also getting benefits from it. And we've done a study at the Wildlife Trust called the Sweet Spot, where it's the sweet spot where you maximize your profits, minimize your costs, and maximize your nature outcomes. It's called the Maximum Sustainable Output, MSO. And that report says you can make profits up to 45% more. They've studied 165 farms. So you can make 45% more money by using nature rather than your normal inputs like chemicals and fossil fuels, which you're using on the tractors, things like that. So, you know, there's some really big wins, but it's hard for farmers to make those transitions because they're a risk. So they need supporting from the market and from governments and from consumers.
Yeah. Those are all many, I guess, essential considerations. There's a couple I would love to add because of the successes that I've seen in the community of regenerative farmers here around Europe as well. One of them, like kind of going along with the intercropping, is first of all, just planting things that do well already under your conditions. Yes. Much like the commoditization of foods that you've been talking about, not everywhere is suitable for growing tomatoes or raising one breed of cattle or, you know, but actually figuring out what it is that thrives under your conditions is already a huge leg up in not needing to use fertilizers, pesticides, and other crop protection products. And then finding good sources of seed that are genetically robust and adaptive. Yes. Yeah.
And yeah, absolutely. Finding the things fit. Sometimes that will mean looking at past maps of your farm, talking to people about what was in your farm, looking at what the fields were called, you know, things like that. Yeah. It can be a bit of history, digging into history, but all just talking to people in your area and or talking to your, you know, father or grandfather, if you know, around or grandmother. And that's a really, really good point. Think about what works for the soil, for the climate, you know, for the contours in your area. The other way also is mixed farming, bring livestock into the system.
Yeah.
And so that can be really great for instance, sheep are great at pest black grass control, you know, which is a real pain. If you don't want to use a lot of herbicides, you start to get black grass, which is a great weed, very successful weed. Mm-hmm. So starting to bring animals in to do pest and weed control, and they also provide a wonderful nutrient into your soil. And that nutrient has an inoculant in it. It has microbes in it. So you're creating a much richer soil for your next crop. But that involves a lot of logistics, you know, farmers who have been being cereal farmers for decades, getting them to think about being livestock farmers and having the infrastructure to do that is a big thing. Again, we need to invest in that, both in terms of money and training and advice. But mixed farming is another one, and rotations and cover crops, as I mentioned earlier.
Increasingly having an entire cycling and functioning ecosystem within a farm rather than just keeping a single crop or a single animal on life support. And life support, oddly enough, is what's killing so many of the other life forms in other places. Yeah. We could go on this part for a very long time because I can see this is a topic of interest for both of us. But let's take a look at a couple of other scales. So we just finished farms and kind of broad acre management. Mm. What about forestry? Have you come across solutions in forestry?
I didn't cover forestry very much in my book, and I work mostly on farming, but there's a lot going on, especially in terms of biological controls, bringing in the bugs that will control, for instance, some of the worst, I think, you know, some quite significant pests of forestry systems, but bringing in some biological controls that will control, for instance, the moths that can be particularly bad in a conifer system. And ironically, in the book, I do talk about the wood ants. Wood ants can provide an amazing ecosystem. They're sort of keystone species within a forestry system. And they found in Scotland, in those amazing Cairngorms forests, when they they did an experiment taking the wood ants out, which create incredible nests. They found more pest infestations happening because those wood ants not only are predators of some of those pests, but they provide a habitat, a shelter for other predators. And they also provide a space for a worm that's particularly important in that area. And that's critical for the soil generation. You know, it goes on and on. The wood ants in their millions within a forestry system, critical part of that ecosystem, as you say. But it's, you know, it's an area also could benefit with more diversity and the right tree in the right place. You know, we've got incredible plantations of single trees with not enough mixture to allow the invertebrates and the ecosystems to provide those kind of pest control systems. So moving away from plantations is another one. But again, that requires the market to do things differently and to reward that kind of system.
Indeed. So maybe one more area of larger scale systems. One thing that I've noticed, which is very commonly overlooked in the way land, especially around municipalities, is managed, is how we manage the edge of roads, public lands, a lot of the municipal landscaping that's done. Where do you see opportunities for bringing bugs back into these landscapes?
There are many. These can be the absolutely critical corridors for, you know, for connecting those habitats, which I was talking about, the stopping the fragmentation, because often the road verges could be, if they're allowed to be, an amazing corridor, but also a refuge and a feeding station. You know, if we allow flowers to grow in those, that requires us to stop allowing excessive nutrients to build up in those road verges. Because, I mean, for many years, our highways agency was fertilizing those road verges, which means that you get grass, you don't get flowers, because flowers tend to thrive where there's lower nutrients, and grass do great with lots of nitrogen fertilizer. But that costs the highways agency. So they stop doing that, save money, and then you get the flowers growing. And you have to mow them at some point because, you know, there are risks if you don't. But mowing at the right point so you've got the seeding set for the next year. And then you've got a huge amount of pollinator-friendly plants. And using the, you know, if you are using seeds, use native seeds and all those situations. But there's all the other green areas, you know, parks, small parks, verges around trees on roads, even companies who have a green space on their roof or around their buildings. And then there's school areas, school greens and parks and sports grounds. All those areas could be really important. I mean, particularly when you've got recreational needs, it's going to be around the edges. But you don't want to be using a lot of chemicals where people are playing, when children are playing anyway. So we should be really investing in integrated pest management in any publicly accessible area and having part of it rewilded, because that will provide the source of those invertebrates and species for the rest of the area. And I think that's one way people and consumers and the public can really get involved, because they can, you know, get involved with their local parks, friends of local parks, lobby their local authority to do things differently. And they might start to understand what farmers have to do, you know, to understand where food comes from. Obviously, in your own gardens, there's a whole load you can do as well. But in public spaces, you're absolutely right. There's a lot to be done. And we have a lot of campaigns here to go pesticide free. So to get your local authority to go pesticide free, we've got the Pesticides Action Network run that campaign. And there's a lot going on. But again, you've got pavements and people are nervous if weeds grow in pavements. So there's a balance to be struck, but there are alternatives to weed killers. You know, it's sort of heat treatment, foam treatment, all sorts of ways. Yeah, it's important.
I also really like the emphasis you've put on the necessity of corridors and points of connection between the little pockets. Those are so essential. And it made me think about waterways and how those function as corridors and connections. Talk about the possibilities for bringing more invertebrate and bug life in our waterways.
Yes, well, we've got a particular issue here because a lot of our waterways are heavily impacted from farming, particularly from nutrients being over-nutrified by the runoff from soils and from fertilizers, but also chemicals, the pesticides. And we also have a big sewage problem. But, you know, with more water falling because of climate change, our sewage system is not coping. And that runoff from that sewage system, when it can't cope, goes into our waterways. All that is absolutely catastrophic. I mean, some invertebrates in the water environment like that, they'll thrive. But that's a very sort of small number of them. And that's we need the mixture. We need the mixture. And we've got some of the most rare habitats in the world. Our chalk streams in the UK are very few across the globe, and they've got incredible fauna and flora within them, which are being destroyed by chemicals, and we should have absolute protections for them. But it does require everybody doing something about this, by supporting the kind of farming, nature-friendly farming, which isn't using so many chemicals, and by lobbying, you know, getting our decision makers to do things differently, to regulate better and to help farmers in the transition, and also regulate the water companies to stop pouring sewage into our rivers. But the kind of things that we want to see are really mixed invertebrate and vertebrate fauna within the river systems. Because, you know, if you haven't got the invertebrates, you haven't got the fish. If you haven't got the fish, you haven't got the fish eating birds and, you know, all that kind of amazing system which goes on around a river system. And the banks as well, the voles, water voles, in beavers. We're bringing beavers back in the UK, which is brilliant. But that, you know, that all depends on a healthy ecosystem, although the beavers can actually help provide that by breaking up the water system and creating what looks like chaos, but is actually a beautiful mixed water environment. And that's fantastic for the invertebrates, because it creates pools and dams and all sorts of different environments. And then the plants, you know, we need the invertebrates and other animals to be transporting the seeds through a river system and river banks, so that those banks become protected and aren't eroding into the water and silting it up, causing it to not work. It's a very, very complex system and full of beautiful animals. And a lot of our insects that we love, like the damselflies and the dragonflies, the mayflies, most of their life is actually lived in aquatic systems in fresh water. And so if we continue to create a hostile environment for them, and part of that hostile environment is that they won't be able to eat if there's no bugs for them to eat, because most of them are actually carnivores. You know, they're like, you could call them dragonflies. Their actual larval form in the water environment looks like a dragon, and it is voracious feeder. It's got incredible jaws and it eats lots of other smaller invertebrates. And if we remove those, we remove the dragonflies. If it's toxic, if it's covered in algae, because the algae can thrive in a high nutrient environment, and there's no other plants for the invertebrates to eat. You know, it's a chain of reaction. And so if we don't have those, we won't have the beautiful insects that we need and love to see.
Yeah, it's such an incredible example of how all of these ecosystems are connected. Absolutely. And how any action that you take on a landscape is going to ripple throughout the web of these connections.
Yeah, it's a system. It's a system. And the soil is a living system. People think of soil as a thing. It's not. It's a living system. Yeah.
Well, and like you mentioned about the dragon and the damselflies, many people don't want to see, you know, wetlands or bog type ecosystems, thinking they're going to bring mosquitoes.
Yes.
Everybody's least favorite terrified. Insect, yes. Think, right? Yeah. But it's quite to the contrary. When you actually have fully functioning, healthy wetland ecosystems, all of the predator species there control the...
Absolutely.
Well, and then the contrast is when you have paved areas or lots of little disconnected
standing water,
areas.
Stagnant water,
Exactly, where you have those little pools. That's actually where you get your mosquitoes.
Absolutely.
And that causes bigger problems than if you have a connected and fully functioning ecosystem. That's really worth bringing up there. And so let's look now at some of the actions, some of the options that people, let's say, with little gardens could start to do, or little access to land and allotments or whatever else you might have control over.
Yeah. Well, there's loads. I mean, there's certain things not to do. And I talk about in the book about if you've got no time, stop mowing so much, stop spraying. You know, you can save money, save time with a lot of these activities. You know, they're great. But if you've got a bit more time, think about growing more crops, with more plants, growing food in your garden or in your pots on your window ledge. You can grow food. And a lot of food is flowering plant, you know, the fruits, strawberries, cherries, you know, and you can have bushes. Bushes are wonderful because they store carbon. So that's useful for climate change. They're incredible habitat for invertebrates. They're often flowering, and they can provide you with fruits in the right season. So wonderful things to have small bushes in your garden. But also, if you've got a very small garden, or if you're not in control necessarily, if you're renting, have some pots, and you can grow flowers, which can be the refuge, the place where that bee needs to rest and to feed. otherwise it could collapse. You know, you could be the one that saves it. And if everybody was doing that in your street, you know, you work as a street to be a pollinator friendly street or a spider friendly street even, you can do a lot to help. And the main word I talk about, I don't want to talk about not using pesticides, that's important, but diversity in your garden, having a, you know, don't just try one crop or don't just try one flower, have a range, and think about the natives as well, because the native invertebrates, the insects will thrive better on plants that they've been used to. So, and a lot of plants that you can get in garden centers, if you're buying plants ready grown, they can be hybrids and, you know, not necessarily ideal. So growing from seed, from what you know, sharing seed with your neighbors, all that kind of thing is really helpful. There's some plants, kinds of flowers that are multi-petaled, which look beautiful and are really difficult for the pollinator to get in. So they tend to avoid it. So try and get some native plants and some basic stuff. And again, suited to your climate, to where you are. If, you know, in different parts of the country, different parts of Europe, you'll need different things. And then do avoid chemicals, do avoid fertilizers if you can, and avoid peat. Peatland is one of our most unique precious habitats. In the UK, we have incredible peatland, which is still being mined. The peat is being extracted to provide compost and to provide the medium to grow plants in garden centres. So we've been working hard to get that banned, because those peatland habitats are basically our rainforest. They're incredibly rich, diverse sites, and they also store a huge amount of carbon, huge, you know, vast amounts of carbon underground, mostly in huge feet, many feet worth of sphagnum moss, which is decayed and stores that carbon forever if we leave it. But if we extract parts of it, it starts to decay and release that carbon into the atmosphere. So avoid peat. But it's more about what you can do and diversity, really, and just experiment. And there's lots of plants I talk about in the book about which are good. Try different levels, plants at low, medium and high, so you maximize the sunlight you use. And if you have got space and the wherewithal, do a wood pile. Wood piles are amazing for beetles, and beetles are amazing pest control. If you're growing some food crops, you know, your beetles can eat all those slugs. And if you can go even further by having a pond. I grew a pond in lockdown, and it's very small, but it's a joy to watch what's in there. I haven't got any large animals, but I can see the hoverflies and the wasps drinking from it in the summer. Real pleasure you can get from that. And wolf spider. I saw a wolf spider drinking from it. That was really lovely to see. But only do that if, you know, if you've got the space. But it's a wonderful thing. It can make all the difference to that idea of a refuge and a stopping point to drink and to feed for those invertebrates across an urban environment or a rural environment. Sometimes rural environments are the most depleted. So we need good gardens in rural environments as well as urban.
Very well said. And I can definitely vouch for that from my own experience in installing water features and doing watershed restoration projects for clients. As soon as you've got a body of water, even if it's an ephemeral stream that is going to dry up later, it brings so much life. I think there's no single installation that you could do on a landscape that is as good for bringing such a diversity of life as a small water body.
It's so true. And if you build it, they will come. Yeah, it's really surprising because I'm slightly surrounded by concrete. You know, my garden is a haven, but I've got concrete all around. And they've still managed to arrive. I've got some amazing pond snails, which are really beautiful. No frogs or other amphibians, but they just couldn't get that far. But
yeah, around here we've got salamanders because we're right by the river. And I was seeing these beautiful black ones with yellow spots in the street the other day because we actually went out at nighttime, which I don't do often enough. And I really like that you mentioned the wood pile as well, because it took some convincing of my partner when I started to break up and stack a wood pile next to our garden. She thought it was ugly and didn't want to leave it there. And I was like, no, just wait. The things that are going to come and live in it are what it's really all about. And you know, plants will grow over it eventually. It's starting to look nicer. But I mean, the insects and the, like I said, the salamanders and all of
brilliant.
The light that comes out of those is absolutely
If you've got a stag beetle, she'd be wowed, wouldn't she? You know, they take a long time. Stag beetles take a long time under the ground. But when they emerge, and you need a wood pile for that, they are the most beautiful invertebrates that you will see, very big and not at all scary. But people were scared of them, but very quickly get used to seeing them if we had more of them.
I'm definitely going to keep a lookout for those. I wish that my ability to identify insects is as good as yours. That's something that I will work up to. I'm still getting familiar with all of the different plant species in this new place that I've called home. But that is the next frontier for me, is insects and birds, and really learning to understand the members of the community where I live now, beyond just the people.
Yeah, in the iNaturalist app is very good on that. You can download it, and it will very quickly identify. Yeah, so I talk to people about that.
And you don't inventory. Yeah. You can build up a list over time and add to it and see how much life is increasing on your space as you
it's
try to
It's really exciting. It. Yeah, and very exciting. And you're contributing to science because you're providing citizen science. They can assess the data. But it's actually such a pleasure when you find you've got a new bug. Every year, I've been here in my garden for 25 years. Every year, I see something new.
Nice.
It's fantastic.
Oh, that is something to look forward to.
Yeah.
Well, look, so as we start to wrap it up, what advice would you give to someone listening to this, regardless of what land they may or may not have access to, about getting started in, first of all, understanding the invertebrate, the bug populations around them, and maybe taking some actions that could make a real difference in how these creatures survive?
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously you could buy my book, but there's also a huge amount online of advice. So if you've got any questions, just you can get it online. There's brilliant organizations, the Wildlife Trust, WWF, the bird organization. They've all got loads of free information of how to build a pond, for instance, or a beetle bank, or a insect hotel, just with the things you've
I've
got in your
those
house.
All over the place. Though.
Yeah, they're really everywhere. Popular. I mean, you know, it's a way of introducing people, and people ask questions so you can explain what you're doing. They're not all that brilliant always at providing habitat, but you know, the thing is to start somewhere. And I say to people, have a rebugging plan, and on, you know, in three areas. The first area is in your house or your garden. Just think of doing one thing that you know will provide a great habitat or food. So it could be growing some flowers, you know, some flowers, or in your house, stopping using any sprays and stuff, and allowing the spiders and other invertebrates there. The other thing is to, in your green space around you, so become a friend of your local park, or grow some seeds on your local verge in your road. So that's the sort of green space. And then it's what you buy, and we haven't got time to go into that, but that makes a huge difference, because so much of you buy, not just food, but your clothes, your furniture stuff, your mobile phone, it all mostly comes from land. And when it comes from the land, it's going to affect the invertebrates here or globally. And I there's lots of information about that in the book. You know, your cotton, for instance, you know, cotton's a huge impact on invertebrates. So is gold, you know, all of it is extracting from land. So think about reusing, repurposing, selling on rather than throwing away, and trying not to buy so much stuff. So that's about you as a consumer. And then the third part of your plan, so that's one and then two, the third part is being a citizen. So start to bug your local authority, start to bug your members of parliament, and really keep on bugging, but telling them you care and you want them to do things differently. So have strong laws on pesticides, strong support for farmers to do the right thing, to go regenerative or organic even. So become that person that stops the government from not doing what's needed, and stops the government from just listening to the agrochemical companies or the cheap food manufacturers. You know, we need a movement of bug lovers to be rebugging, to counter the huge pressure from an industry which is quite harmful. I don't mean the farmers, I mean those directing what the farmers are doing. And that's really important, to be a citizen in this. So be a rebugging citizen as well as a rebugging consumer and a rebugging gardener.
Wonderful. And I know that there are a few organizations, you went over a couple of them quickly, that can assist in these areas.
Absolutely.
Can you give me a few more ideas?
Well, the Wildlife Trust, which is who I work for now, have got an unbelievable array of guides on their website. Just look at the wildlifetrust.org. Everything you could want and need to think about in terms of invertebrates. Really, it's quite extraordinary. But most of the conservation groups do now. And there is one organisation in the UK called Bug Life, which has been it's been dedicated for 23 years to policies to help the invertebrates. So if you can support that organization or all those other organizations. That helps them to do their job and do the lobbying that they need to do. But there's a whole list in my book of other organizations. And the other thing is looking at in your local paper for local organizations, because there'll be local ones that are, you know, the Friend of the Local Park or the Get Pesticides Off Our Streets campaign, you know, Pesticide Free Towns. There was a Bee Friendly Town campaign in Monmouthshire, which got the council to be the first bee friendly council. And loads of verges and stuff. Good. So that, you know, looking local as well. And you can, you know, find new friendships and communities and well-being sort of can really grow if you start to do that as well. And Friends of the Earth, I mean, there's loads of organizations that they're UK I'm thinking of, but many across the country. In terms of farming organizations, Nature Friendly Farmers has been brilliant. Absolutely brilliant at really helping farmers to see they can do things differently. And this is conventional farmers as well as organic and permaculture. All of them matter, and every farmer can do something differently, but they need that support. Nature Friendly Farmers Network, and the Soil Association, you know, in Europe, there's IFERM, which is the International Federation of Organic Movements, all providing helpful, useful material. And there's a Garden Organic as well, which can help you to garden organically and grow all those fruit and veg that you've wanted to grow in your garden. They're really helpful. I'm just about to sow my beetroot, which I'm obsessed with. So I'm looking forward to doing that. Yeah,
I'm really looking forward to growing that this year too. I'm just getting my garden really up and going this year.
Yeah,
because it took us a while to get our fences, and we have a lot of wild boar, so I didn't make
last
year. Yeah,
you've got wild boar pest problem. That's quite something, isn't it?
It's a little bigger than insects. It requires other approaches. But I'm also very much looking forward to the gardening season and ideas like this and new opportunities to bring all these other forms of life, which are so often ignored and then misunderstood, especially as far as the value that they bring to our lives. I mean, Vicky, I'm so glad that you took the time to write this
book. Oh, my pleasure. It's great to
shed light on this issue.
Real
quickly, where can our listeners find a copy of your book and get in touch with you if they would like to?
Well, I've done a website. It's not perfect, but it's rebuggingtheplanet.org. And the details are there of where you can get it. It's published by Chelsea Green, but available in all good bookshops or online. And in the website, if you can't afford the book, I've got a lot of the tips on there. I've got pictures. And the latest blog I put up was what things you can do with children in a school setting or a home setting or a community setting, because that is just a wonderful thing to do. As we're moving into spring in this part of the world, that's the perfect time because they start, all the invertebrates start rising. And right now it's a bit cold, but very soon it's perfect to get bug hunting and looking for the signs of bugs as well, like the leaf miners in leaves and children, you know, you can tell them to go and find them and they can tick them off. But yes, you can get into my book, any good bookshop.
Well, those are all fantastic resources. I will put as many of them as I can into the show notes for this episode. And Vicky, thank you so much for taking time.
My
pleasure. This was a wonderful chat. Thanks once again to Vicky. You can find links for her books and her other projects on the show notes for this episode at regenerativeskills.com. Before we wrap this up, just remember that these episodes are only the beginning of the learning resources, design and coaching services, in-person courses, and interactive community that are available through Regenerative Skills. The Discord server is our free community where you can connect with other like-minded listeners, exchange ideas, stories, tips, and resources, as well as interact with me directly and quite a few former guests from this show. Our Instagram account, @regen_skills, is the best place to see the projects that me and the team are working on, both for clients and collaborators, as well as on our own properties. I'll also be announcing the certification courses, workshops, and gatherings that we've got coming up later this year. If you're interested in getting dedicated support for your own project, you can now schedule a free planning session with one of our team members through the request form on our website. You can also find all the links, show notes, and past resources there at regenerativeskills.com. We truly believe that no matter your experience, your knowledge, abilities, resources, or background, you can be a powerful force for regeneration on this planet, and we're here to help you find your path. So as always, remember to keep taking those little steps every day towards a regenerative future, and I'll be right by your side along the way.